IT businesses in Sacramento, California.
From somewhere deep in the cloud and the corners of the earth, this is the Killing It Podcast, with a focus on helping you make sense and dollars of all things IT, with your hosts, Dave Sobel, Ryan Morris, and Carl Polachuk.
Welcome to episode 88 of the Killing It
Podcast.
I'm Carl, and I'm joined today by Dave and Ryan. And we have a special announcement. So finally, after many, many moons, Amazon and Audible have figured out how to do podcasts. And if you have an Audible account, you can listen to the Killing It Podcast for free on Audible. Just put in the search term, the Killing It Podcast, and it'll show up. And you click on it, and it will be automatically added to your Audible feed.
Or tell your friend who listens to Audible and listens to books and needs a new source of fun and interesting conversation about technology and business.
I have long been convinced that the Audible audience is a bunch of people who are way more organized and have more free time than I do. Because I always think, yeah, I'd love to participate in that. And then it's the next day and I don't have time to listen to the audio content. It's phenomenal loyalty that they have over there. The fact that they finally figured out podcasts, like, welcome to the ballgame. But it's a very interesting place. I aspire to be an active Audible listener.
I did have an account for a little while and I did not listen enough.
Backlog of, 12 books, but also they give you a little snippet. Like every day you can listen to like 30 minutes of somebody reading the Washington Post for free, 30 minutes of somebody reading the New York Times for free. So there's a lot of good stuff on there. Plus, almost all of my books are on there. So,
Carl's on there. But is the New York Times or the Washington Post read to me in soft, dulcet tones that make me feel better about the world?
I would say no.
That was a terrifying headline, but it was read with such deep baritone. Exactly. I feel okay about it.
I feel better about the world.
And then the cruise ship crashed into the seas.
See, now I want historical events read to me in soft, dulcet tones, like it was a news story. And I just want to hear what that would sound like.
You need the NPR reading the Hindenburg crash.
I do, especially because if you think about newsreels from like circa those times, that is not in soft, dulcet tones.
No,
it's much more aggressive.
It was very
funny to actually redo all of those old news tone videos. So just do a voice.
Oh, we've thrown an idea out to the world. I would listen to that podcast.
Well, why don't we do this podcast?
We should. Before we dream up other podcasts, let's do this.
Let's do this one because we actually have some fascinating topics to send with you into the wide world of your own deep thinking of new ideas. So I'll take the first one here. And this one is... what is this? Episode 9,1100 and whatever of the technology industry overhypes new inventions and then eventually gets disappointed before they realize, hey, that was actually a really good idea. What I mean by this is a report that's come out from our friends at MIT. Again, as Carl said last time, we really like research that's done by smart people because it provides some very deep and meaningful interpretations. The point of this report is to say, that story we've been hearing about how AI is going to disrupt the world of white collar work in much the same way that robots disrupted the world of blue collar work a few decades ago. And all y'all are about to be out of work because an algorithm is coming to take your cubicle from you. The upshot of the research is, well, not so fast. There is an impact on job creation and job obsolescence, but not nearly at the pace that some people have forecast that it will take away all these white collar jobs. But what they're finding is it's not necessarily putting people out of work, but what it is doing is exaggerating the separation between the haves and have nots, high income, high thinking jobs versus everybody who gets stuck in a world of doing menial tasks. And again, Carl, this one used one of your favorite words, the reskilling terminology of the way that we get around this problem is we need to figure out how to make humans more meaningful in the working world and train them to do the work of the future. I thought this was like not just the article, but the report that's associated with this. This is where I spent an evening of my life. And I think it is absolutely fascinating because I do believe AI is coming for your jobs, but it's not going to be nearly so immediate as people thought so. What do you guys think about what MIT was saying?
It kind of buried the headline a little bit. I loved it. Some jobs were being destroyed while others were being created, even as an overall employment generally kept rising. It's like, oh, okay, like all other technological revolutions, this one follows the same path.
Well, there's always a fear that technology is going to eliminate jobs. And the truth is it eliminates jobs that were on their way out anyway. And you know what we've seen, I mean, one of the examples is Amazon with their shipping centers. They've probably introduced more robots per existing employee than any other company worldwide. And it's dramatically increased the number of people they're hiring. They're hiring hundreds of thousands of people at a time, not just to fix the robots, but because the robots have sped up and automated all the things that were repetitive and dangerous.
Now look,
it allows human beings to do things that robots can't do so much.
I will put my society hat on for a moment because I always bring this up. Like, look, it is the job of a society to figure out how to retrain workers and move them into new and help them into new jobs or offer opportunities for education. Like, that is what a healthy, vibrant economy does. And those of us that are thinking long term are having the conversation about what that means. I do say that it's not necessarily the individual company's responsibility, except as a part of a larger system where they contribute to it to find that happening. So that's the bit that I always like to link the two. You know, it's unpopular to pay taxes, but by the way, you'd like to have workers. The two can be linked.
Yes. And see, this is the thing, right? The part of the article that says, yes, but there are jobs, there are more jobs, there are always going to be jobs. But if you look inside the numbers, wages have radically stagnated because evidently technology is getting the interesting jobs and people are being left to do the ho-hum, oh, by the way. And I believe what I'm taking away from this research is, yeah, but that's completely upside down because the reason that humans can still justify their position in the working world is that the human brain and the human hand are still infinitely more specializable, to bastardize a word, than any machine or algorithm will ever be. The algorithm is what the algorithm is. And then we can tweak it and we can refine it and we can write a new one for another task. In the meantime, a human just said, oh, this is closely related to the task that I was doing, but just a slight tweak. I can learn to tweak my approach to things. That's what humans are good at. Humans ought to be in the higher skilled, more adaptable roles as opposed to just the blah. But higher roles cost more money. And apparently, as a society, to your point, Dave, we're all okay just saying, yeah, you know, if you're not one of the top 1 or 2% of job values, it's okay if you still make minimum wage.
Except I do have to say, news in the last 10 days is that Walmart, Amazon, many companies are in fact dramatically increasing the wages of their lowest paid workers. So, you know, it could be that we went through that phase and now we're learning something else. I was just talking to somebody this morning on my inside my community about how, you know, a lot of people are realizing that, you know, turnover costs more money than getting a new employee.
Shocking.
And so, you know, shocking. Yes, I know. But, you know, minimizing turnover and, you know, money isn't the only way to do that. But at the low end, money is the easiest way to do that. Right. Well, once people earn, you know, the whole Daniel Pink thing, once people earn enough money, then a little more money doesn't really help them out. But
right.
At the low end, it helps a lot.
Right. And we need to be comfortable with long-term investments in some of these spaces. These are not problems that we're going to solve immediately, but by the way, they do pay off. And we need to find ways to reward that long-term thinking, you know, across society and business, because, you know, we can definitely see the investments pay off over time, and we can see economies accelerate and opportunities expand. But oftentimes we want to spend a dollar to make two, you know, today, and that isn't necessarily the way we can deploy every one of our investments.
See, and that's exactly the challenge, Dave, is that the social approach to long-term upskilling of humanity, that it's like that has to happen over the longer term, but in the immediate term, a business who needs employees who can perform a specialized task can't wait for society to figure that out. As a human who has spent many years teaching other advanced professionals how to do new things, I think that that is, you can't wait for society. Individual companies or consortiums of them need to invest in training for their people, because you can't just expect schools and society to fix that for you in time.
Well, and in a let's make lemonade sort of approach, whether it will happen in this recession, which has probably got another year to go, or the next recession, at some point we will realize that in order to really get the most out of the robots, we need to have systems in place to retrain people, not just to fix the robots, but to be more efficient in a world made possible by more robots. Because exactly, that world is coming whether you like it or not. So, you know, you're not putting the genie back in the bottle. You just got to figure out, you know, what are we going to do going forward? That's a long-term kind of plan.
Plus, I really want to keep the robots from, you know, taking over and becoming our overlords.
Right, exactly. Well, if you just limit them each to one arm, that limits how much damage they can do to you.
Now, there's an interesting test.
It ain't Turing, but it's valuable.
All right. Are we done with that?
I believe we are done with topic number one. Topic number two.
All righty, topic number two. So I love this. I did a blog post recently where I kind of, you know, it may be a little long and a little depressing, but I looked into, you know, the different ways that the social media are being manipulated and by YouTube, Facebook, and so forth and so on. Anyway, in all of that, stumbled across a rich, rich site I didn't know existed, which we'll put in the show notes, but it's basically stratcomco.org, which is run by NATO, and it is their security publications site. I did not know that NATO has a quarterly publication called Robo Trolling, and it is literally a quarterly journal of information and statistics and analysis of how companies and nation states are using social media automation to troll, you know, what's going on in the news, manipulate people's behavior. And it's quite dramatic, and the statistics within the publications are phenomenal. So I, you know, first homework from Killing It podcast is go sign up for this site and go download a couple of these publications.
We've given you your long reads for as you come into the holidays.
Thanksgiving vacation.
Yeah, again, a commitment of things to read. However, Carl, I'll go exactly where you went. I started reading The Black Market for Social Media Manipulation. And I don't know, I got three or four pages in and I had to get up and go for a walk around the house these days, right? But I had to go for a walk and work out some stress there. I was like, holy crap, that's frightening that they are, well, A, I'm not surprised that it's happening. B, I'm really disturbed by how effective and how efficient that model is. But it takes me back to a place a few years ago where, you know, the technology industry realizes that connectivity is that's the circulatory system of an information economy. The internet unleashed a lot of multiplier or network effect opportunities in business. We all became much better at communicating, and then you realize that can be used for good or it can be used for evil. The people who are using it for evil, they're good at it. And they are well funded. They are dispersed. And as you know, again, to your point, the fact that NATO tracks this and quarterly writes a publication on this thing, this is not a couple of guys in a basement doing some angry things. This is a mature industry. This
this is not, you know, two guys with aluminum foil hats.
Yeah, no, this is a professional industry, and they are well dispersed, well funded, and really altering the effect of our world. And it just looks like another post on a social media platform. I do not wish to wear a tinfoil hat ever, but when I see things like this, I'm like, you know, that's not an exaggeration. This one is not an overreaction to a supposed conspiracy theory. This stuff's actually out there, and it is tearing down society for a living.
So let me pull a thread. So I'm going to pull a thread from the Business of Tech, and I don't assume everybody listens to all of our shows because, you know, we're prolific, right? But I say oftentimes over there, I've been focusing on the cybercrime side of things, right? And I've been focused on the fact that the ransomware deployers are running incredibly organized businesses. My most recent data points were they have an affiliate model. If you'd like to sign up to get 70%, you know, revenue streams with them, they have an affiliate model. They issue press releases. They actually announce changes and strategic changes, and they do recruiting. They have an interview process. Like, they're actually run like true businesses.
Some of them have discount coupons.
Right. Oh, I mean, it is an actual thing. Like, you can shop. I can cash in my coupon that week. But so what I want to pose for this topic then is like, how do we change the conversation around the way we talk about security? Because everyone talks about it from the perspective of, oh, we're just playing we essentially are playing defense, right? Like, you have to put some products on your system, you'll do some backups. Oh, and you're, by the way, going to lose. Like, you're going to eventually get hacked. Like, what conversation about security and data management and this, you know, social media infrastructure should we be having going into the next year in order to really change this? Is it about verified identity? Is it about zero trust? Like, how do we change this?
Well, I think the biggest change is we need to move away from, in my opinion, the fear factor, right? We've so much of security has been sold on, you know, 60% of the people who lose their data go out of business, blah, blah, blah. And it just doesn't feel real to clients because they've heard this now for 50 years. And guess what? They're still in business today and it doesn't affect them and so forth. And there's some of this stuff, especially this black market report that we linked to. It points out that there's kind of this gray area that we don't talk about much, where you could buy clicks on your media, right? You could say, oh, I want my YouTube video to go viral, so I'm going to pay somebody a bunch of money and they're going to give me 10,000 clicks within 7 hours and, you know, beat the algorithm. Okay, a legitimate company could do that, but it kind of looks like the same behavior that these illegitimate companies are doing. And I think educating your clients about the fact that these things are out there, and it just, you know, it sort of goes from white to gray to black market, right? That there is this continuum and they need to not be participating in the kinds of things that lead them down the wrong road. But I was a little surprised at how I thought all this stuff was on the dark web. And in fact, you can just go to Bing and look this stuff up or go to Google and it's right there.
See, that's exactly the point, right? They're not even bothering to hide this stuff. And yet it is for entirely what I will call destructive purposes, right? They're not here to help. They're here to cause problems. I'll go back to, I don't know if you guys ever read the book called The Big Switch by Nicholas Carr, right?
Yeah.
Right. So like the first half of that book, I read that and it was the first time somebody did a really good job of articulating what we mean by utility computing in a practical sense. And I thought that was fascinating. The front half of the book, I was like, woo, this is a great way to get people to understand an emerging concept. And then the back half of the book was like, oh, and by the way, don't kid yourself. Nation states will use this as a new military weapon, and the attacks across digital borders will outnumber and out destroy the physical attacks across geographic borders. I read the second half of that book and I was like, okay, now I'm depressed. Like, you know, it's one of the books where the front half was the most encouraging and the back half was the most discouraging experience that I had. And back then I thought, well, you know, we just have to hope that smarter people than me are paying attention to the second half of that book and doing something about it. My conclusion is they were not. Nobody was doing anything to prevent this from happening. It has flourished in the marketplace. And now every one of you in the world of the technology channel working with individual clients has to have a strategy of how do you defeat or at least insulate your clients against these kinds of campaigns, because they are rigorous. They have better marketing science than most technology vendors do in their through channel marketing activities. This is sophisticated stuff. They can package a campaign. They can track the posts and the touches and the hits and the impressions, and they can give you a dollar per somebody down a dark rabbit hole type of a metric. It's out there. What are you going to do about it for your clients? Because your clients' business, their brand, and their employees are at risk to this kind of content.
So look, I'll throw out before we go into the next topic, but I mean, I love an education-based strategy, because education around this style of conversation is super important, and it moves you to a much better conversation about business impact, about data management. It's like, it's way smarter, right? It's a way better conversation than, hey, I want to talk to you about patch management. I want to talk to you about like your downloads, like all of that kind of stuff. So it's a better conversation. I do think I want to open the question of, I'm making that recommendation not actually knowing that it will solve the problem, because I am not, we've been doing a ton of education style initiatives around security for a very long time. And last I checked, we are losing this war. So I don't want to say like, hey, let's do more of the same. Now, I want to emphasize that I like education because it is conversations you need to have with customers about their data, about the way they interact with the technology. That is valuable on its own, but I do leave it as a bit of an open question whether or not this is actually the solution. And I really would, this is that kind of moment where I want to say like, hey, listeners, like, I want to hear other solutions too, because I'm not entirely convinced.
Well, go ahead.
I was gonna say, like, it kind of ties into our next topic a little bit in the interest of time.
I just wanted to throw out one more thing, which is that there are these different categories within this and some segmentation. And I think at some point we will revisit this primarily because there's different pieces to this market. And, you know, different clients are going to be exposed to different elements of the quote unquote, the dark side. And right. So, you know, I would like to see, I'm going to dig into more of the NATO site, but I would like to see if they have prescriptions rather than simply descriptions.
Yes, the scary report did not, and so that's why
the scary report is,
yeah, thank you for the education. I am now going to go back into my safety spot and I'm going to do the la 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 rocking back and forth to ignore the scary people.
And why do I have a feeling that the NATO guys have way better safe places to hide than I do?
Yeah, but their prescription was good luck, suckers.
Right. With that bit of snark, I will move on to another bit of snark, because you know it's a day ending in Y with social media that I just could not resist the catnip of bringing this one. So came out as we're this is releasing after the Thanksgiving holiday. This came out right before that. Facebook did in fact tweak the news feed to highlight more mainstream news sources after the election. In fact, they decided that an uptick in viral misinformation related to the election results and the president's refusal to concede needed extreme measures. And so they made a temporary change to their newsfeed algorithm to favor mainstream news outlets. This leaves with the hanging question, well, why don't you do that all the time? Because, you know, and it does certainly rebut at some level their statements of, oh, we don't have control over this. Well, clearly there is a knob that they can turn to dial up or dial down the virality of the news that's being spread.
See, this is all of us getting ready to practice our shock and aghast faces.
Yes.
Facebook manipulates the news feed. What?
What?
I do have to say, once you admit that there is an algorithm and that it was written by your employees, it seems bizarre to make the argument you can't change it, right? Well, it's not like it's changing their business model. It's changing what we see.
So what I want to walk away with is we could have, we could go down the social media flogging route, but that's not interesting. What I actually want to bring up is the, do we define an algorithm as something that is like a publisher? Like, is that the same at some intellectual level, like a human editor, and should be treated in the same way versus kind of the original idea of protections under, in the US, Section 230, where the idea was like, look, if someone is posting something, the web host, for example, is not responsible for that because it is that person doing it. But is the algorithm now making them more like an editorial publisher?
Well, and again, to Carl's first point there, hell yes, because A, that algorithm was written by a human for a reason to accomplish a business model objective. They didn't just put it out there and see what it would do. They wrote it. It was written by a person on purpose to accomplish a business objective. By definition, that's you editing the flow. You're not just allowing the flow to happen and giving it a place to be published. You edited it on purpose, and therefore you are responsible for the choices that that algorithm makes.
And, part of it is we want Facebook to filter a whole bunch of stuff. I don't want to see murder videos. I don't want to see, animal torture videos, right? We want them to do that. So the extremes are easy, right? It's when you get close to the big gray line, it's like, okay, what constitutes political? What constitutes opinion? It's in the middle where they want to have free discussion, but then there becomes this question of, something that we didn't used to question what is real until about, 4 years ago.
Somewhere around there.
And it's become a legitimate question of what is real and what is fake. And, at some point, I guess Facebook has spent enough time saying, we don't want to be part of that conversation, even though they are part of the conversation. So I think as long as there's filters in place and I'm not watching murder videos, they are a publisher. They are choosing what will be on their site and what will not be on their site. And again, it's easy at the extremes. It's in the middle where the conversation actually
goes. Well, and I would be remiss if I did not point out, for those that immediately start thinking, First Amendment. First Amendment's about governments, not about private entities, not about private platforms. It is about the government interfering. This is not censorship, but in the First Amendment definition of censorship.
But again, the natural next step in that conversation is self-regulation. The industry wants to be allowed to govern itself so that government does not impose that kind of control mechanism on them. And then they say, but we're too big to self-regulate, so we're not even going to try. Meanwhile, we are absolutely controlling everything that comes in here through our algorithms, and we're just telling you that we can't do it to accomplish your objectives. That's the definition of you can do it, you choose not to do it, therefore somebody needs to cause you to do it. And that's the area where, again, Carl, exactly where you're going. There is a massive gray area in between that does not need to be regulated because it is the marketplace of ideas. And yet, when Facebook says, well, we can't even control the edges because it's far too big, far too complicated, we can't afford to hire that many human editors. I know you don't even need to hire that many human editors because you adjusted your algorithm on purpose one time that proves to me every other time you said, but I can't even control it.
But, you know, the odd thing is, and I'll just say as a political science guy, the only speech that needs to be protected is offensive speech.
Yep.
Right. But right. The odd thing is that if they are saying, well, we're not going to focus so much on these media, we're going to focus on those media, that is an intentional choice. But now, instead of being, you know, manipulated by the left and the right extremes, they're being manipulated by what these other media are choosing to put up. And Facebook doesn't control what ABC, NBC, and CBS put up.
Well, remember, they're doing this to monetize by selling you ads. Because I could envision a version of the product where instead of Facebook having control of the algorithm, the user has control of the algorithm. Like, so for example, I have the ability to custom tailor all of the knobs, and I could change everything the way that I wanted to. And I had control of it. And for example, I could envision a version of this where we all paid $3 a month, right? For the version where I control the algorithm and I turn all the knobs and I customize it the way that I want. And I have transparency into the way that it's done. And I can pick and choose my news sources. And I can do that. Like, I can envision that version of a product, and I can envision the business model. Now, well, that's not the one Facebook runs.
What you are describing is Apple News Plus, right? I pay a fee to choose among hundreds of magazines, newspapers, blogs, etc., to filter based on my interests, based on my trust factors of publications, based on things that I find to be worth my time. And then it creates a news feed based on my input, and I pay for that privilege. Facebook is telling us, no, you don't get to choose. I get to choose because that allows me to make the margin on advertising. And if we've had this conversation 1,000 times, if I am the product in the Facebook world and they wish to manipulate what comes in front of me, well, then by definition of your business model, what you said is that you can control what comes in front of me. Therefore, you should.
And unfortunately, Dave, I think the problem with the paid model that you just described is that people on the left would choose these resources and people on the right would choose those resources, and they would do what the old algorithm did before, which is amplify what they already believe. And mm-hmm. I don't know that we as a society would be any better off. If people just want to go into their corners and into little echo chambers, we don't have an actual discussion in the middle.
Correct. My paid newsfeed is definitely unique to me. It is my own echo chamber, and others would look at it and go, why do you find that interesting? But that's because it's me and I paid for the privilege. We do need a town square where we can have an actual exchange of ideas.
Well, we have one. It's physical and it has pavement and it's around the corner. And it's so let me just observe.
Town square.
Right.
I have to go to the outside? What?
Right. Let me observe. We have these physical spaces that, by the way, are generally outdoors. So you can be 6 feet apart and you can have a conversation. I'm just observing that, you know, we don't necessarily need a private online digital experience to have that when we do have something. But
Mark Zuckerberg would like to have a word with you.
Well, he has more money than me. He can fly here.
He can buy advertising on the podcast.
On the podcast to say whatever he'd like.
All right. Well, that is it for this show, but please join us again. Tell all your friends, like it, tweet it, you know, give us a thumbs up and all that.
Listen to it on Audible.
Yes, listen to it on Audible. In the meantime, thank you for joining us for episode 88 of the Killing It podcast.
Thanks for tuning in to the Killing It podcast. Please share with your friends and tell everyone to subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, and all the podcast places. Join us next week and help us keep killing it in the technology business.